In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate that everything, simply everything you could possibly think of, has its own history, like babies, toenail clippings, and cheroots.
Oh, or babies' toenail clippings. I remember when my two were really young, trying to clip their toenails was terrible. And I'm sure there's a history about that, as there must be a history about moles, voles, and holes, scrolls, trolls, and another kind of holes, as in the entirety of something. However, this is to monstrously digress as ever, because what we're supposed to be doing is following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Dr. Sam Willis, who knew that the history of sheds is in fact all about the Grade 2 listed Devon House, or the writing hut of Henry Williamson, he of Tarka the Otter fame. It's also about the American naturalist and philosopher Henry David Thoreau and Walden Pond. It's about boys' toys, men's sheds, a room of his own. And it's also about community sheds in modern-day Australia. Did you know that?
No.
No.
Yes.
Of course you did. Or that the history of bathtubs... The history of bathtubs is all about prohibition in the United States. And this was a homeschooling podcast from way back in lockdown. We are no longer in lockdown, are we? Which is good news.
No longer in lockdown, and so we've stopped with our homeschooling, but they were immense fun whilst they were going on. Let me introduce you all to my fellow presenter. Let me just say that if history was an apple perched on the head of his only child the present day, this man would be none other than William Tell. So steadfast is his arm, so true his aim, so trustworthy is his ability to target the past with precise arrow-like research. He is none other than Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. He is Professor James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. And you may well be wondering, who is that unattributed voice that I've already explained who you are already, which doesn't work, so ably helping me co-pilot these episodes? Well, let's just say that if he were a trust-related historian, he'd only be the exact opposite of King Charles I. He of English Civil War or British Civil War fame, in the sense of being the opposite of untrustworthy. So regal and reliable is he, so trustworthy are his endeavours in the archives, so majestic is his mastery of the past. Yes, you've guessed it, it's your friend and mine, the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
Hello, everyone. We're doing the history of trust, and I can't for the life of me remember how we came up with this one. Have you got any idea?
I know exactly how we came up with it, because I'm doing a lot of reading for various things at the moment. And when I come across something that I think, oh, that would make a great topic for a podcast, I scribble it down. And this time I was reading something about 17th century Dutch merchants' correspondence and trust. And I thought there has to be a way that I can crowbar that into an episode.
Well, I'll tell you what I could crowbar into an episode is that I've been doing some stuff recently on 17th century Dutch traders in the Gulf of Cambodia.
Ooh,
and
looking
at some shipwrecks there. There's some really interesting treasure hunting going on in the kind of late 80s. An Australian guy called Mike Hatcher And he found two extraordinary wrecks laden with Chinese porcelain. And the what made the porcelain particularly rare and interesting is that it was purely for the for an Asian market, which meant that the designs of the porcelain was not manipulated or adjusted for European market. So in the same way that the Chinese food that we eat in England is very rarely actually Chinese. So the same way is that a lot of what we think of as Chinese porcelain is not actually particularly Chinese because it's been corrupted or changed for the European market. Anyway, so it was purely Chinese designs around about the 1640s, 50s, I think. Fascinating stuff. So there you are, a bit of 17th century Dutch history for you there. Just crowbarred in.
Oh, that's superb. Talking of, before we go on to trust, talking of Chinese porcelain, I've just read a very excellent book by a historian called Anne Gerritsen called The City of Blue and White, which is all about Chinese porcelain and the early modern world. I think you should check it out, Sam. It's absolutely stunning. But yes, as you say, we are doing the history of trust.
Well, do you know what? It all kind of links to that because I suddenly thought, well, how on earth am I going to do trust? You obviously had the advantage of knowing exactly what you were going to talk about, having read a book about trust. And I wasn't entirely sure, but I suddenly thought about money and exchanges and checks. I've always found checks completely crazy, that you could just write you know, on a bit of paper and sign it, and someone will give, you know, I give Daybell £100 and then you take it somewhere else and then they give you £100 of their money. Never really understood that. And anyway, immediately thought about my... all the work on I've done with trading, particularly with the East, with Asia. I thought there was a huge amount of interesting trust issues there. I thought about trust in war, particularly betrayal of trust. And also kind of linked with that, an idea of national identity and who some people consider to be foreigners coming into their own country and who they feel like they are able to trust. I think there are issues of national identity and xenophobia and racism there as well. I thought that because I was driving around this morning at 7 o'clock in the morning and there was a van in front of me that had a sticker on it that said, "I feel like a foreigner in my own country." And we had a bit of a debate about whether it was going to be a black person or an Asian person who was, you know, born and bred here but then feels uncomfortable because of racism, or whether it was a white person who was just being racist, basically. And it was unfortunately the latter, I think. Anyway, interesting, and there are all sorts of parallels there about how you can trust people who've come into your country anew. Lots of really interesting ones from the Second World War, with the French government trying to get locals in France to trust German soldiers.
Ooh, I must admit, although I read that article on Dutch merchants and trust, I actually unpacked many more interesting things. And I think there are all manner of ways of studying the history of trust. And if we unpack it, I mean, first of all, we need to think about what it means. And it can mean reliability, that somebody is good to their word. It can mean honesty, integrity, all of those kinds of things. Then you can start thinking about people or institutions that you trust, and the way that you were talking about. So governments to run the country in an appropriate and orderly manner that is fair and equitable for all. Legal systems that ensure justice and the application of law. And across history, do you trust those? Thanks for your, you know, trust can also be to look after your money, banks and institutions that don't go bust, you know, and make you lose everything. And there's an interesting history here linked to things like the Wall Street crash or the South Sea bubble, you know, those kinds of things where people lose confidence or trust in an institution or a market. But also, I think it's about interpersonal relations. So it's about the people around you that you interact with on a daily basis, who you might trust or put your trust in. And we can think here about people in authority, whether it be policemen, teachers, firemen, church ministers, and a betrayal of trust in these people that, you know, that makes it morally bankrupt, demeaning, sometimes criminal. And here we can think about the history of childhood and childcare, a state intervention in the family, and the way in which the role of these institutions as caregivers has often been unfit. You know, and people in great positions of trust have in fact you know, have in fact sort of gone against that trust and actually, you know, behaved in ways that are criminal, particularly, you know, I'm thinking about child abuse and those kinds of things. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but also more personally, we can think about it in terms of close relationships, not of people in authority, but those that you bump into on a daily basis. So friends, acquaintances, family. And I've been listening or looking at the work of the St. Andrews-based philosopher Catherine Hawley, who I recently listened to on one of my favourite podcasts, Philosophy Bites. If you've never listened to it, I've been listening to it for ever since it began, years and years and years. And they've got about 350. And I listened recently to the episode that they had on trustworthiness. And here what it's about is that imagine that you are a parent and you might rely on people to look after your kids, to take them somewhere safely, to have sleepovers, to babysit them. Trusting them is that you think of them as reliable. It's something that you value. It's the opposite of those people who are flaky or untrustworthy, who overcommit and can't fulfil what is promised. They're people who are unreliable. So that's the opposite of trustworthy. But there's also a parallel in people who are too trustworthy in their own minds. In other words, they like being thought of as trustworthy. It's part of their identity. But actually, that means that they often don't overcommit, that they let you down because you can't rely upon them. So in actual fact, it's the very opposite of trust, because you can't trust them because they are so, you know, they are so they're so sort of keen on being trustworthy that you can't trust them, if there's some sort of weird irony there.
Whoa.
But anyway, check that out. Great podcast. Philosophy Bites and Catherine Hawley on trustworthiness.
Fascinating stuff.
Where are you going to go with trustworthiness, Sam?
Do you know what? I was going to start with checks. I will start with checks. But it just made me realise that when you're talking about governments and, you know, trust and faith in sort of big society, it made me realise how much of a contemporary issue this is, particularly around vaccines. And I bet there is a fascinating history of early vaccines where essentially, it's like a mental flip, like to protect you from smallpox, I'm going to inject you with smallpox. I'm really interested in how that played out and what role trust had in that. And I bet it was really, really important. So not only just with the original inventor of the vaccine, but then actually being able to roll that out across a huge public who all needed the vaccine, but were probably suffering from a lot of the problems we're suffering from now all over the world. So a lack of education, a lack of knowledge, lack of understanding of exactly what the vaccine was and how it worked. So some interesting parallels there. Anyway, checks. I'm just going to start with checks because I think they're really, really, they're so weird. The more you think about them, they're really very strange indeed. And I found some interesting history that highlights this. The history of checks actually goes back to the Roman period. Even there's some similar kind of promissory note from the Maurya Empire of India, which is a fascinating Iron Age historical power of South Asia. If you've not come across that before, I'd go and have a look at it. But it's also, unsurprisingly, it's the Muslim traders of the ancient world who set the precedent, because they had so many extraordinary challenges they had to deal with. So complex was the trading systems across the Silk Road. And in Arabic, you have the Huwala, and in Persian, it's called the Suftaja, which is it's a letter of credit, essentially. And that allows merchants to transfer and exchange currency to others over long distances. And Islamic regulation deemed that these letters had to be honoured. And they found letters in cities like Cairo and Siljmasa, which is modern day Morocco. And they've shown that letters of credit like this, up to 40,000 dinars, which was a fortune at the time, they existed from a period around the time of the First Crusade. So we're talking 1096, the end of the 11th century. So huge notes we know existed there, huge sums being honoured by something other than the money itself. And that shows you how important trust was in the world of trade at the time. But these kind of promissory notes are actually different to the modern concept of the check itself, and that is believed to originate in Islamic history in the Saqq, S-A-Q-Q. And that was also due to a need to travel over long distances, particularly due to the dangers of carrying large numbers of coins with you. And not only dangers, of course, but the practicalities, especially if you're carrying gold because it's so unbelievably heavy. We know, for example, that the city of Basra, modern-day Iraq, by the mid-11th century, so it's 1040s, 1050s, anyone could deposit their assets with a changer or a banker who would hand over a receipt. And from then on, any subsequent purchase is made by a means of draft on that banker who had to honour it when presented by the vendor. And that meant that those, over time, those drafts themselves become kind of exclusive currency for many merchants. And it makes international trade, especially along the Silk Road, it actually makes it possible. And you realise just how important a significant monetary system based on trust was to the way that that trade system worked. So a bit of simple stuff there. And I did come across a wonderful story as well of the mockery of the system. A humorist called A.P. Herbert, he's a British humorist, 1890 to 1971. And he started writing for Punch in 1910. And he regularly wrote about a chap called Albert Haddock, who often falls out with the government. And he wrote a story called The Board of Inland Revenue versus Haddock, otherwise known as The Negotiable Cow. And what happens is that Haddock has a row with the government about the amount of taxes he owes. And to pay it, well, he gets a cow and he writes on the cow, to the London and Literary Bank Limited, pay the collector of taxes, who is no gentleman, or order, the sum of £57, no, zero shillings, zero pence, and may he rot. And he signs it Albert Haddock. And it then goes on to kind of explain the lunacy of the system, and also the kind of the flexibility of it. You learn through the story that, you know, checks were written on the backs of menus, on napkins, on handkerchiefs, on labels, on wine bottles. And he's taking it a step further and says, like, why on earth can I please not write a cheque on a cow? And it goes on and on, but it's a truly wonderful story, bit of satire about the exchange rate and also the government and also the collection of taxes.
So the history of
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Trust, then, is all about writing on cows, Sam.
Absolutely.
This sounds like histories of the unexpected as of old. This is brilliant stuff, Sam. I have something rather more heart-rending. I've been reading a brilliant book by an American historian called Laura Briggs, and it's called Taking Children, A History of American Terror, because I'm really interested at the moment in looking at separation of parents and children. I've spent a lot of time reading all sorts of things from throughout history to look at this. And where I think the trust comes into this is that where the state intervenes in the family in order to remove children from family settings that they see as unsuitable, they experience violence and neglect and whatever, there is a trust in the state to act in a trustworthy manner. So to actually fulfil their duty as custodians of these minors, so of these children. But actually, looking back over the past, there is such, throughout history, across periods and cultures and continents, there is such a betrayal of this trust. And this is one of the things that comes through in this book by Briggs. And what she does is, it's actually quite a slim book, but really powerful. And there's a series of sort of thematic chapters that look at the long tradition in the United States of state intervention to remove children from the custody of what they deem to be undesirable parents, whether these be slave children separated from families at the auction block, whether they be Native American children taken away for unsuitable alcoholic delinquent mothers, or black children seized from negligent parents, or even in Latin America, the children of suspected communists taken from their families, or more recently in the 1980s, crack babies taken from junkie mothers, or, you know, right up to the present day, Donald Trump's administration separating children from their families seeking asylum in the United States. And this is a rather sadistic, politically motivated form of terror. And it is an act of terror because it is about instilling fear in particular groups of people to stop people, you know, trying to migrate to the United States. And I think in each of these cases, you know, for the children and their parents, the experience of separation was really traumatic. And, you know, and again, they are absolutely betraying this trust. And if we dig a little deeper, you see this everywhere. And particularly there's a particular theme in indigenous peoples around the world. So if you take, for example, Canada, from the 1870s to 1990s, an estimated 150,000 First Nation, Inuit and Métis children aged between 4 and 16 years old were removed from their families, and they were forced to attend Indian residential schools in Canada. And the purpose behind this was assimilating them into society, forcing them to abandon their native language, culture, way of life. And these institutions were funded and run by the government and various churches, Anglican, Methodist, Presbyterian, Roman Catholic, United Churches. And it's estimated that there were 139 such establishments operating throughout most of the Canadian provinces and territories. The last school closed in 1999, and the kids who were attended these schools were forced to endure a regimen of academic learning, religious prayer, chores, and conditions in these institutions were brutal and cruel, with children being exposed to harsh punishments, violence, even sexual abuse. There are tales of children who spoke in their native tongue having pins pushed through their tongues to stop them being able to speak. And these widespread practices, you know, have really cut deep into the lives and psyche of First Nations people who feel utterly betrayed. There's the psychological impact of separation of families, this forcible acculturation, the inhumane treatment of innocents, resulting in an estimated 6,500 children dying from disease, neglect and other causes. And, you know, this is, you know, a deeply scarring history and betrayal of trust in Canada. And you'll have seen in the news over the summer the discovery of more than 1,000 unmarked graves believed to belong to Indigenous children found at sites of former residential schools, not only in British Columbia, but also in Saskatchewan. And this culminated in a remarkable event that I discovered this summer. A friend of mine living in the US, a brilliant friend of mine called Ari Burke, drew my attention to this event. And on the 1st of July 2021, Louise Bear Mohawk Bear Clan mother of the Iroquois Confederacy travels to Parliament Hill in Ottawa, the country's capital, to address Mark Miller, the Minister of Indigenous Services, member of the Canadian Parliament, following the discovery of these unmarked graves, demanding answers for why these terrible acts were covered up. And Louise Baer, who's, you know, first woman to be, you know, elected to this position, used the symbolism of Canada Day to invoke Mother Law and take back the name of Canada, which was derived from the native Iroquois language. And her speech, Sam, is so powerful, it's worth quoting at some length. "We arrive here today to ask for the original peace that we had originally agreed on and to return to an original relationship and understanding between our countries. And so I ask you today, on behalf of your parliament, on behalf of you being the face of the country that built its wealth on the blood of our babies, I ask you why. Why did your country try and hide such a premeditated, heinous act to take the innocent blood of our babies and create your wealth, and then use our language in your infancy to name yourself? I ask you. We know why, but I want to hear it from you, because there can't be healing unless we understand why. We're in a moment of history where we need to right the wrongs, and so, with the authority invested in me to name and non-name, I ask you to answer my question. If you're unable to answer me, then I invoke the authority that I have, that I take our name Canada back and put it in my basket, and you'll be a nameless country." I thought this was absolutely incredible. The sheer power of it, that sense of total mistrust, of total separation, alienation, of children separated from parents, Indigenous peoples segregated in their country, a country Canada separated from its name, and all of it sort of breathed through with this lack of trust in a, you know, in the state. Absolutely extraordinary, Sam.
Yeah, no, I love that. That's really powerful stuff. It does make me think about this this poster I came across, which is from the Second World War, and it was part of Marshal Pétain's plan to save France from war. And it particularly targets refugees or population abandonnée, so abandoned peoples. And at the bottom, it just says, "Faites confiance aux soldats allemands." And so have trust the German soldier. And there's a picture of three bedraggled French kids. They must be, a bit of daddy analysis here, I say they are about seven, between seven and so six and eight, maybe. And the smiling, tall, handsome, smart German soldier in his uniform, he's taken off his hat, his helmet, and has on his left hip one of these kids who's smiling. She's eating a bit of cake, and then kind of around his feet are two other children, perhaps this little girl's sisters or anything. Anyway, everyone's having a wonderful time. And clearly the child who has trusted the German soldier has been rewarded with something to eat and is having a tremendous time. And there's a couple of other kids looking a bit shocked at what's going on here. But I found that quite extraordinary, because, James, with all of this, you've got different levels of trust. So one is yes, OK, try and please trust the government who's going to look after your child. Or in your case, there's this huge betrayal of trust, but there had to have been trust, you know, at least some kind of attempt at suggesting that what they were going to do was well-intentioned. And then you have the betrayal of trust here. So they're trying to portray a situation in which you can have trust in the government. And then obviously what happens is this extraordinary betrayal of it as well. There are similar examples, some fascinating ones, Japanese propaganda posters also from the Second World War, particularly passed out through, I think, the Philippines, but also in China after the Japanese had invaded China. And they're trying to convince them that the new powers are going to look after them and look after their interests. It's a very interesting graphic challenge, and if you look at the posters, it's fascinating to see how that was actually realised. But, you know, one other point I came across as well was also very interested in the whole business of going away, primarily because I spend a lot of my life not at home. And it made me think about the Crusades, and there is a very interesting history of trust there. So very briefly, let me just tell you about this. The problem is you've got a wealthy landowner who's going to go to Jerusalem, and ideally he's going to come back with more than what he left, but he has to leave someone at home to look after his everything he owns, his land, his property. And what happened is that regularly on the return by the Crusaders, the people who had been left in trust with the land, with the houses, refused to give it back. And they did so with the full weight of the law behind them. Because they had been put in trust of this stuff, the Crusader was not then allowed to force them or to require them to hand back the property. So lots of people didn't. And what happened is it happened again and again and again. And the only solution was for the Crusader to petition the king. The king would then pass the issue on to his Lord Chancellor. And that was then solved by the Lord Chancellor's Court, which became known as the Court of the Chancery. And what happened is that over time, that Court of Chancery would continually recognise the claim of a returning Crusader. But it took a while for that to set up. And the term use of land was coined, and also in time it developed into what we now know the word as trust. And that's where it came from, because this person was placed in trust to look after someone's land.
Very good, Sam. Now, I want to end with our inspiration for this, which is that little article that I read, which is by a Dutch scholar in a journal called Dutch Crossing, and it's from 2012, and it's by a woman called Susie Zylstra at the University of Amsterdam, and it's called To Build and Sustain Trust, Long Distance Correspondence of Dutch 17th Century Merchants. And this isn't just Daybell epistolary geekdom. This is actually really interesting as well. I got reading this because I was working on long distance communication. So effectively what you've got is people separated by distance working with each other. And here what we've got is long distance trade. So you've got a merchant, you know, merchants, you know, hundreds of miles from each other. And how do you build trust between them? Also, this is a time when you have the development of credit systems. And how do you give somebody credit? In other words, how do you rely upon them to pay you back at a future date unless you know them? And crucial here for establishing this level of trust is, of course, the way in which you communicate with them. And you can communicate with them in the 17th century by letter, of course, which is why I'm interested in this. But, you know, if you then unpick the letter, communication and trust comes through writing to them politely or courteously, but also writing to them on a routine, regular basis, telling them lots of information, news about how the exchange is going, how the trade is going, when the ships have left, if there are any problems with the weather or with the oceans or that kind of thing, so that people can be guaranteed of your trustworthiness. In other words, what it shows is that you are dependable and you are hardworking and you are reliable, and that they will then be able to trust you in the future. So the whole article is really about how correspondence was used in that way. And it goes through a whole range of examples. But one of the most interesting things is the models that are provided in letter writing manuals in 17th century Netherlands that tell you the kinds of things to write. And there is a popular letter writing manual from 1597 in Dutch. It is Gemene Zendbrieven, which is translated roughly as common send letters. And these letters are, there is a model letter here where it says, there are several points which a good merchant should maintain well to do with all piety his merchandise, one of the principal things of which is that he keeps to his word as well as he can, to establish faith and reliability and to keep it. For if a merchant is not true to his word, he loses reliability, without which one has to do traffic or business with much difficulty. Also, a merchant has to be attentive with his pen, write down his affairs well, and keep a good account, as often much evil can be prevented this way. Also, a merchant should keep in mind not to conduct business with people of light means. And then what it does is it trots through a series of different examples of correspondence and the kinds of things that people might put in their letters, good practice, bad practice. And then it gets to a great example, a series of letters written by a man called Jan van Rieven. And what we get is through his letters, which are written before and during the Third Anglo-Dutch War, sort of 1672 to 74, you get a sense of how a Dutch merchant is able to correspond with people. The news that he gives, the details that he gives of ships leaving, ships arriving, when things have been dispatched, whether there are problems with delays. And what we get is a sense from these letters that he is able to build up a solid, reliable reputation for somebody who is trustworthiness. He is able to get extended credit and build his enterprise. So there we are, Sam, our founding gem of an idea, 17th century Dutch merchants and the building of trust through correspondence.
It's wonderful stuff, James. I reckon we could do several episodes on the history of trust, but that means we've come across a goodie. We've come across a cracking topic. I reckon you can historians all over the world could be doing projects on trust in the Crusades, trust on the Silk Road, trust in the 17th century Dutch trading, whatever it might be. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. I hope you enjoyed that, guys. Do please follow me on social media. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you're interested in maritime and naval history, please check out the Mariner's Mirror podcast.
And if you want to follow me on social media, I'm at James Daybell. The podcast is at Unexpected Pod. If you're interested in the stuff that I was talking about, children, watch me on the 24th of Friday. I think it's Friday, the 24th of September at the Futures 2021 event. I'll be on at 7 o'clock in the evening. I was going to say in the morning, in the evening. And it's going to be live streamed by the University of Plymouth. So you can get to see me and ask me questions about it. So it'd be good to see you there. You can also check out more about us on our website, historiesoftheunexpected.com. And if you want to support the podcast, we also have a Patreon page.
That would be hugely appreciated, guys. We're on a mission to change the way people think about the past. And anything you can offer will allow us to produce more episodes. It's as simple as that. Thank you all so much for listening. We are back with the history of chaos. See you next week.
Bye, guys.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.